Hello, and welcome to New Books in Philosophy, a podcast channel with the New Books Network. I'm Carrie Figdor of the University of Iowa, and I'm co-host of the channel along with Robert Talese. In our fortnightly interviews, we talk with philosophers about their ideas as elaborated in their newly published books. Today's interview is with Herman Capellan, professor of philosophy at the Arche Philosophical Research Center at the University of St. Andrews. His new book is Philosophy Without Intuitions, which came out this year from Oxford University Press. It's taken for granted among contemporary analytic philosophers that some of their primary areas of inquiry, ethics, epistemology, philosophy of mind, and philosophy of language in particular, involve a special characteristic methodology, one that depends essentially on the use of intuitions as evidence for philosophical positions. A thought experiment is developed in order to elicit intuitive judgments, and these judgments have a special epistemic status. Paradigm cases of this methodology include thought experiments by Gettier, in which we determine whether we intuitively think that the subject in the scenario has or does not have knowledge, or Putnam's Twin Earth cases, in which we claim, again, intuitively, that while Oscar on Earth thinks about H2O, his molecule-by-molecule duplicate on Twin Earth thinks about another item called XYZ. The new experimental philosophy movement also accepts that this methodology is in fact rampant and is premised on rejecting it by conducting real experiments rather than thought experiments to see whether we really do hold these intuitions, or who does. Capellan argues that as a descriptive claim about the practice of philosophy, this is all false and muddled. The idea that intuitions play a critical role in contemporary analytic philosophy is a claim made by philosophers in moments of what he calls confused meta-reflection on their own practices. On his view, a detailed look at the thought experiments themselves shows that the term intuition or intuitively, all of these uses of intuition talk don't have a single interpretation. In many cases, it's just an unfortunate verbal tic. In others, it means a claim is a snap judgment with no special epistemic status. In others, it just makes explicit some sort of background or pre-theoretic information that all parties to the dispute take for granted. What is not going on, he claims, is that the judgments elicited have bedrock epistemological status, are considered justified without appeals to experience or without inference, that inclinations to believe these judgments tend to be recalcitrant to further evidence, or that these judgments are based on conceptual competence or have a special phenomenology. So let's go to the interview. Hello, Professor Capellan.
Hello.
Hi. Welcome to New Books in Philosophy.
Oh, thanks very much for having me on.
Well, I'm very excited to be talking about your new book, Philosophy Without Intuitions, because it's a very challenging, critical look at the practice of contemporary analytic philosophy, a sort of sociology of philosophy. Before we get into the details of the book, maybe you could give us a little bit of background on how you came to this topic and how you came to write the book.
Well, I think all the work I've done in philosophy has been in part methodologically self-conscious. In fact, I think it's very hard to do any philosophy without thinking all the time about how we go about doing it. I think it's one of the characteristics of philosophy that we're constantly thinking about how to do what we're doing while we're doing it. So from the very beginning when I started doing philosophy, these very general questions about how you could go about doing this, those questions were always central to me. In my first type of work, my first book was called Insensitive Semantics, and one of the topics of that book was what kind of evidence, what kind of data could be used to support certain kinds of theses about context sensitivity in natural language. And my thought about that book was that it was more or less entirely methodological. There was questions about how to go about adjudicating certain kinds of debates and what kind of data we should be focusing on and how to interpret that data. So thinking about methodology has been central to how I've done philosophy always. And I think to most good philosophy is methodologically self-conscious. About 5 years ago, I guess now, or 4 years ago, here at the Arche Center in St. Andrews, I started a project with my colleague Jessica Brown on philosophical methodology. It was a four-year project with weekly meetings, many, many workshops and conferences, all focused around questions about meta-philosophy. And one of the core questions in that project had to do with the role of intuitions. Most of the discussions we had about that topic were questions about whether intuitions were the kinds of things that could be relied on as evidence in philosophy. But my underlying suspicion from the beginning there was that, well, maybe we should question more fundamentally whether it even is the case that philosophers rely on intuitions. I noticed that this was common ground in a lot of these debates that people were having, even among people who seemed radically opposed to each other, like methodological rationalists like Bieler on the one hand and experimental philosophers like Stitch on the other hand. They had common ground in that they thought the fundamental method of philosophy was that of appealing to intuitions. And so I thought, well, you know, it might be worth trying to at least explore that assumption. And so the more I thought about it, the more implausible it seemed to me. And so I thought, you know, I think it's worth trying to write this book and try at least to get people to be a bit more explicit about why they make that assumption before they make it and before they go on to create research projects based on it. So yeah, that is the sort of more immediate background for the book.
So you organize your critique of this idea. You call the idea centrality, which claims roughly that intuitions and appeal to intuitions are evidence or a source of evidence for philosophical theories. And you argue that it's false. You know, you present two main arguments against that claim. So maybe you could just say a little bit more about your claim that centrality is false. There's no interpretation of it in which it's true of much of mainstream analytic philosophy that intuitions do play a central role.
Yeah, before I say why I think it's false, let me just say a bit how the kind of picture that underlies the thesis that I call centrality is one that should be familiar, I think, to most practitioners of the profession and any even undergraduates getting into the profession or into the subject. Mm-hmm. So here, the picture is very, very natural when you read contemporary literature. It's that what we do as our most basic methodological tool at the starting point of theorizing, there's an activity roughly like this. We construct thought experiments or cases. It might be about trolleys. It might be about twin earth. They might be about bank cases. They could be zombies. Whatever your area is in, there's some kind of canonical set of cases. Okay. And then we just have some kind of immediate, spontaneous reaction to those cases, and those are intuitions. And now theorizing is the project of trying to make coherent, systematize, predict, whatever your model is, of some sort or other, this sort of core group of judgments, the intuitive ones, that's what we're trying to capture. And so on this picture, intuitions serve as evidence in philosophy, and philosophical theorizing has those kinds of judgments at the origin. What I found interesting is that this assumption that that's how we go about doing things is, I think we should think of it as an empirical hypothesis. And that's, it's something to be checked whether that is what philosophers really do. And when you go and look into philosophical texts, and this is what I do, I think the most interesting way to look at this is the second part of the book, when you go careful study of the kinds of cases where that's alleged to be what is going on, it just turns out it isn't what's going on. It isn't true that philosophers just construct cases and then have a kind of judgment that is naturally described, or even plausibly, in any level of plausibility, described as having an intuitive reaction to them. That just isn't what's going on. Now, it's fascinating, I think, the question why so many people think that's what's going on. That's a bit of a mystery to me. Why we are so, if I'm right, there's a kind of very broad confusion about what we are actually doing. But that's a separate question. So the question you just asked was, what do I mean by saying it's false? I just mean it as a purely as an empirical claim about the kinds of cases that are supposed to be paradigms of that method that I described. It just turns out they're not instances of that.
Well, you discuss a couple of different objections to that, but maybe we should get a particular thought experiment on the table just so we have something to make the discussion a little bit more concrete. There's a number. As you go through, as you just mentioned in part two of the book, you run through in a very detailed way a particular paradigmatic thought experiments and what goes on in those. You mentioned David Chalmers. The conceivability of zombies. There's Putnam's Twin Earth. There's, of course, the Gettier cases. So there's Thompson's Violinist. Right? All of these cases appear to, as you just knew, appear to involve constructing a case, a thought experiment, in order to elicit a judgment. And then your response is that in all of these cases, in various ways, the judgments that are elicited don't have certain features that you say that intuitions, if intuitions were playing a role, they would have these features, and they don't. So maybe you can explain that aspect of your critique.
Yes, so that's exactly how I go about doing things. So the picture that I had that I thought, well, I initially thought about, well, how would I go about checking that in all these cases where we're supposed to be relying on intuitions, that is what we are actually doing? And I thought, well, it would be helpful. It would be reasonable to expect that there was some evidence to be found in written texts, for example, some diagnostics that would tell us that that is what's going on. So I read through the very extensive literature on intuitions in philosophy. Now, it turns out there's hardly any agreement on what an intuitive judgment is. So the received view, the view that we're relying on intuitions, is very hard to interpret, just because different proponents of that view mean very, very different things by the intuitive or by an intuitive judgment. In fact, I guess my view is that, and I argue this in chapter six, I think it's chapter six, that term is now so used in so many different ways and in so many confusing ways that it's probably completely deficient as a theoretical term and maybe even meaningless. But I think the charitable thing to do here is to try to think of a very liberal account of what the intuitive would be, and I pick three. I consider a number of others, but I think these are three, and I sort of and then take the disjunction of these. So one of these, the first, which goes through almost all the literature on intuitions, is that they have a certain kind of distinctive phenomenology. Mm-hmm. That's supposed to be a mark of the intuitive. Another that pops up in lots of the literature is that they rely on conceptual competence in a peculiar way. Sometimes that's described as relying solely on conceptual competence. In other words, it's the kind of judgments that you can make without relying on quote-unquote empirical evidence, but all you need is your conceptual competence. Mm-hmm. So that's the second kind of diagnostic. The third kind of diagnostic is simply one where they have a certain special epistemic status, maybe roughly described as they can justify, but they need no justification, so they have that kind of special status. Now, each of those, I think, can be interpreted in different ways again. But so what I do is I say, well, if all of those three are absent, there's no evidence of anything like that, that's at least a bit of evidence that there's no reliance on the intuitive. So I have a very, very sort of liberal account of what would count as evidence of a reliance on the intuitive. And then what I find in all these cases is an absence of all of that. That was the surprising part when I did the sort of empirical work here. So just to take a concrete case, for me, the best case... Also, let me say first what I think is a very bad case. I think Gettier cases have been discussed in almost, you know, like 80 to 90% of all papers on this. That's the one case that people focus on. And I think it's an extremely unusual case. I don't think in general what people say about it is right. But I think even no matter what, you should not be focusing on that case. I think it's a very bad example of thought experiments in philosophy because it has so many peculiar features. So I think a very realistic case is Perry's case or set of cases. In the paper, The Essential Indexical, those are... Most of us know those. They're incredibly influential. They're fantastic cases in a way. They brought our attention to very, very important features. They've generated incredibly interesting literature and so on and so forth. So, and they're cases in the most straightforward way. And so to remind the listeners of the most famous one of those, it's Perry walking around in the supermarket. He's noticing a messy shopper. He's thinking that shopper needs to rearrange the bags in his cart, not realizing that he's the messy shopper. He wanders around looking and looking. And it's only at the point where he realizes I am the messy shopper, where there's an emphasis on I, that's when he stops and starts rearranging his own shopping bags and clean up after himself.
Yeah.
And so Perry's question is, well, what happened there's this, he had a belief, it was a belief about himself because he was the messy shopper. Suddenly he had this first personal belief and something happened. Now here's a question you can ask, given the kinds of diagnostics the three kinds of diagnostics that I outlined earlier. Can we find a presence of any of those three in a judgment that is being made about that case? So that's the procedure that I had. I say, well, let's look at Perry's paper. And then, you know, there's more than 1,000 papers written about this later. So I think we shouldn't look just at his paper. We should look at the larger context of that literature. But for right now, let's just look at that paper. Is there any evidence in that paper that he thought it was important what kind of phenomenology he had when he thought about the difference between that guy is making a mess and I'm making a mess? And there simply isn't any evidence in that paper or in any later discussion that the phenomenology made any difference whatsoever. Is there any reason to think that he relied or tried to rely solely on his conceptual competence when he made a judgment about the difference? And again, the answer is no. There's clearly no attempt by Perry or by other people in that tradition to rely solely on their conceptual competence. Is there any claim in that paper about the difference, the juncture where he switches from that guy's making a mess to I'm making a mess? Is there any point in the paper where a claim is made that has some kind of special epistemic status of the kind I described earlier, that it justifies but is not in need of justification? That's a very tricky question to answer, but I go through many different interpretations of that and many attempts to look at it, and uniformly, I think the conclusion you'll come to if you look carefully at it is that the answer is no. In effect, what happens in Perry's case is you find someone drawing our attention to a very important and interesting phenomena, and as Perry says straight off, he says, this is all incredibly puzzling. So you react to that with puzzlement, not with any kind of judgment of the sort that the intuition or centrality proponents would predict. And then There's a number of theories being considered. I think the paper goes through 6 or 7 theories about what you could say. Arguments, considerations, evidence is given for and against each and every one of those possible reactions to the case. And then at the end, he has a tentative conclusion. But the empirical claim that I'm making about that text is that at no point will you find anything that's properly characterized as intuitive. And so, yes, as you said, I this was just one illustration of this. And I go through a whole bunch of other cases. I talk about Burge and Thompson's violinist, talk about trolley cases, lottery cases, True Temp, Fake Barnes, Relativism. Bernard Williams and Personal Identity, Chalmers and Zombies. And in all these cases, the pattern sort of continues. They pattern with the Perry cases I've described it, not with the what I think is a caricature of philosophy as we find in those who say it's intuition-based.
Well, how about, I mean, let me just try a different case. And, you know, I'm thinking of in philosophy of language / mind, various Burge's or Putnam's cases for externalism. You know, we imagine the twin earth or the arthritis case, and or Block, Ned Block's China body, you know, against arguments against functionalism. And in these cases, there's not so much, there doesn't seem to be as extensive sort of discussion maybe as in Perry. But the basic idea, and again, maybe this is just caricature, but you know, you construct the thought experiment. You've got this guy on Earth and a guy on Twin Earth, or you have the people of China arranged in a certain way, and then the judgment is elicited. You know, surely, you know, the guy on Earth is thinking about H2O, and the one on Twin Earth is thinking about XYZ, or surely functionalism is false because you know, because intuitively, you know, the people of China are not instantiating, are not that their instantiation of the functional role doesn't make them a mind, or Burge's case. So in those cases, those seem okay. They seem to fit the caricature or paradigm of the method of cases or thought experiments in which you construct a case, you elicit a judgment, and that's your, you know, that's your conclusion, right?
Yeah. So I think that's what people believe. I think what's very important here is to go back and really read these original texts. So when I started this, I was just going to do 2 or 3 cases like this, and then people said, every time I looked carefully at a text, it turned out that they fit the pattern of what I said about Perry. And then someone said, no, you really got to go read, you know, right, Thompson and violins, or you got to go read this or that.
Right, right.
Of course, I'd already read them, but I didn't really remember all the details. So I would go back and read them very carefully, and I'd be just shocked by how easy it was to say the kind of thing that I just said about Perry, about any one of these cases. So the next case then after the Perry one is Burge that you just mentioned. And I mean, maybe the case I'm even the most convinced about doesn't fit the caricature, because Burge makes a claim about how we would report the mistaken patient who thinks she has arthritis in her thigh. Mm-hmm. And then, in effect, what he does for 30, 40 pages, and it's a fantastic paper, you know, he goes through endless number of possible objections, reinterpretations of the claim she believes she has arthritis in her thigh, which is, it's not that there's this, nope, she believes she has arthritis in her thigh, end of story. It isn't like that. It's 30 pages of careful interpretation, reinterpretation, argumentation, evidence adduced, all kinds of theories appealed to justify what ends up being the correct initial response, namely she does believe she has arthritis in her thigh, and then certain consequences, important consequences, follow from that. So I think you will find that's the empirical part of the project, and I'll be very happy to see people go and, you know, not just remember sort of roughly from their undergraduate days what these papers said. And I'm not saying you're doing that, but I, you know, really go in and look at each sentence by sentence, and you'll be very surprised to see how much of a simplification that caricature, or what I think to be a caricature, is. Now, I mean, there's another level to this. Of course, sometimes some philosophers just say, make a claim about something or other, and sometimes it's just a thought experiment, and they don't argue for it, and they just assume it, they just say it. But again, that still leaves it completely open whether that particular judgment is properly characterized as an intuitive one. There are many reasons why people say things in papers, mm-hmm. Without arguing for them, or you know, that has nothing to do with anything having to do with intuitions. So every argument has premises. We can't argue for all our premises because we write like 20, 25 page long papers. So by the nature of writing and conversation, we will say things that we don't argue for. So in many cases, things will be just said and assumed to be in the common ground of a conversation, or the presumption being, yeah, if you ask me, I'll tell you why I think it. But none of that has anything to do with a reliance on the intuitive. That just has to do with the necessity of having some assumptions in place when you argue for something. So the point of what I just said is sometimes you'll find things that are asserted, claimed. Sometimes that's about a thought experiment. No arguments are given. But that doesn't, there's a big step towards saying that, you know, that is an intuition in the significant philosophical sense. Either it comes with a special phenomenology, it relies only on conceptual competence, it has a special epistemic status. None of those things need be true. It could just be that, hey, I wrote a paper, I assume P, I'll write a next paper, we'll be defending P. So one way I do, you can explore whether a claim in a particular article is just of the kind that I described, just something that, you know, is open for further exploration in future work, is to see whether the literature treats it in that way. So I think what you will find, for example, in the Twin Earth literature is, well, I think you'll find even in Putnam extensive discussion of all these things. But let's just suppose that Putnam never argued for what he said about Twin Earth. Mm-hmm. There's now, I don't know how many thousand papers written about this. And what you will find in the larger philosophical debate is extensive discussion of every possible alteration of alternative descriptions of those cases. And then defenses, arguments for and against. That, I think, doesn't prove that there is no intuition there, but it still it throws some doubt on it, and it places, I think, the burden of proof, at least, on proponents of the intuition-driven picture of philosophy, where these judgments have these distinctive characteristics of the intuitive.
Well, could one give one of the responses, and again, you do discuss this in the book, is just the idea that maybe intuitions play a role in a somewhat weaker sense, and so one of the thoughts that I had was the idea that when we're using intuition pumps, the idea is to expose certain claims, you know, whether you want to consider them as sort of pre-theoretic common ground or some place to start a snap judgment that then gets examined further or some sort of a background assumption. And the idea is to elicit these judgments in order to scrutinize them. And philosophy is precisely about doing that in a way that, in comparison, let's say science will take certain background assumptions for granted, not just takes certain background assumptions for granted, but also in taking them for granted, there is really no effort within science itself, at least not in day-to-day science, to question those, to expose them, to criticize them. So in that sense, does this practice actually do something that is methodologically distinct and important, even if what's being done does not fit the, you know, the usual ways of, you know, the specific phenomenology or the epistemic role or any of that that you use to characterize the use of intuitions?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think all those things you just said about philosophy is true. I think philosophy is distinctive in many ways, and one of them, maybe the most important way, is that we question assumptions that no one else questions, and we will bring out of the common ground, make it explicit assumptions that other people just take for granted. That's one of the reasons it's so wonderful to do philosophy, is that we allow ourselves to do that, and that there's really nothing that we can't question. But that practice is almost the opposite of what's being described by the proponents of the view that philosophy is intuition driven. I mean, what you're describing is the attempt to make what others take to be implicit, what others take to have in the common ground, we make it explicit, and then we argue about it. It's not that that's incompatible, complete, you know, it rules out the intuition-driven picture, but it throws strong doubt on it, because now what you've done is you've, take very radical claims, like, you know, the church ones believing there are no beliefs, not something that is questioned by most anyone else. And what we now have is not a set of intuitions or primitive, immediate judgments. We have complicated chains of reasoning, theorizing, evidence from all kinds of sources being brought to bear on the question of whether there are beliefs or not. That doesn't fit very well, or maybe not at all, with the picture of these judgments being intuition-driven. So I think what you were describing is, yes, that is a good picture of a very important feature of philosophical practice, but it isn't one that sits well with the assumption that we, at the foundation of everything we do, there are these special kinds of judgments called intuitions, and that they drive everything we're doing. In fact, I think what you're describing is a good way of thinking, of getting to a point where you realize that's false.
Okay, so, well, you in part one, I mean, to kind of move back in the book, your first argument is what you call the argument from intuition talk. And I know in the book you point people to the second one, where you have the, you know, very, very detailed and close discussion of cases. But in the first part, in the argument from intuition talk, you suggest various reinterpretations of how we should, you know, understand when people say intuitively P. And you describe it as a kind of a verbal tic, in ways that has somehow sprung up in philosophy, or analytic philosophy anyway. Could you describe that argument?
Okay, well, just a little bit of background. So I think one not unreasonable pressure towards the view that philosophy is intuition-driven, or one reason for thinking that we analytic philosophers rely on intuitions, is that we use those words so much. So that, I think, is a sort of the most immediate surface level kind of reason to be driven towards what I take to be a wrong picture of what we're doing. You pick up a more or less arbitrary journal today, and you'll find people saying intuitively blah, 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 intuitively this, intuitively that, all over the place. And you might think, well, hey, look, how could you say we're not how can you say philosophy is not intuition driven? They use these words all the time. And so for someone like me who says philosophy is not intuition driven, it's an interesting project to try to figure out what we're doing when we say things like that. So that's the topic of the first part of the book. And I think it's very helpful to look in somewhat careful detail at particular texts and contexts in which those expressions are used and look at both the noun, the adverb, the adjective, the verb, and they all have slightly different features. Very roughly the conclusion I come to, I mean, it's complicated because I think there are many different interpretations, and maybe the easiest way to think about it is I see that kind of usage as not referring to or indicating that we denote a source of evidence. It's a sort of speech act modifier most of the time is how I see it. So if you ask me, so here's the way to illustrate my thought about this. If you ask me, why didn't Sally come to the meeting today? And I say, I think she's in Paris. I haven't given you as an answer to the question that she is not at the meeting because I have that thought. That isn't the answer. The answer is that she's in Paris. I think that was put in there to hedge, to modify my assertion that she's in Paris.
Right.
So the answer to the question wasn't, Herman thinks that she is in Paris and that's why she's not here, because she's so worried about him thinking that. I mean, that could be the case, but that's not the natural interpretation. The natural interpretation is she's not here because she's in Paris, and I think was there just to modify that speech act. And so I think intuitively, blah, 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 is a way of being modest in various kinds of ways, being careful, being cautious, not being too assertive. Just what that means, not being too assertive, hedging, that's what the chapter is about. And I go through that in somewhat of a detail. I think there are different ways of being cautious in that way. So, I mean, just to sketch quickly, I think one way to hedge is to say, you know, roughly speaking, I haven't thought very carefully about this yet. Yeah. Another way is to say, I assume we can agree that, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are other options as well. I mean, sometimes I think, and this goes back to something you mentioned in your question, I think we do use these kinds of locutions far too much, and it's become a kind of verbal fashion. Just how it come about is a bit of a mystery. And so I think in many cases we could just take it away and nothing very important would remain. Nothing much important would be missing if we took it away.
Yeah.
So I think one strategy is just get rid of it. What you would lose is maybe a bit of modesty and caution.
Uh-huh.
In other cases, you could try to make that modesty and caution a bit more explicit. But whichever way you go, there's no reason to think that just because we use those terms, we are committing to or talking about a source of evidence or a certain special kind of evidence. That's the thesis anyway in part one of the book.
Yeah. You also have a very interesting critique of experimental philosophy, which basically, the whole idea of experimental philosophy, that whole movement, the recent movement, is all about saying it depends on this assumption that philosophy or analytic philosophy to now has been a prioristic thought experiment driven, intuition driven enterprise, and we need to get away from that. We need to actually, you know, not just intuit what we would say or what the folk think, but actually go out there and do experiments and find out what do the folk think. And on your view, this is a mistake because, as you put it, it attacks a practice that in fact does not exist. So what do you, on your view, you can, you know, expand on that, on your critique, but also what do you think then that experimental philosophy is doing that's worthwhile, or what it is doing at all, if it can't be attacking a practice that doesn't exist?
So, as I mentioned to you, the project that I ran here with Jessica Brown for the last few years, we've had a number of experimental philosophers that I think they're all very good philosophers in many ways. But so I would wish to have something very positive to say in response to this question. But the truth is that I really think that movement is just an absolute, complete failure, and there isn't anything good about it. So I wish I didn't have to say that, but that really is what I think. I think it is fundamentally based on the assumption that what we do as philosophers is founded on intuitive judgments. That assumption is not true. So I don't think there's anything for the movement to do. I think going around checking on people's intuitions has nothing to do with what philosophers do, because philosophers don't rely on intuitions. So now you might think, and there are many attempts when I say this, experimental philosophers say to me, well, you know, we can rephrase the whole project in ways that depends much less or maybe not at all on the assumption that intuitions are at the center of philosophy. I still haven't seen that done in any way that is even remotely plausible. I mean, just I think it's when you encounter these attempts to reinterpret that tradition, mm-hmm. it is worth going back looking at what they really wrote. I mean, you know, this sounds maybe hostile what I'm saying to XFI, but I think it's worth remembering that Stitch and the original experimental philosophers were extremely hostile to contemporary philosophy. I mean, their goal, Stitch's goal, and you know, many writings and in public. You know, front page of the New York Times is analytic philosophy is dead. We can't keep doing philosophy the way we've been doing. So they were incredibly negative, incredibly critical of the kind of work that we are doing. Go back and look at those criticisms, and you will find over and over again that they are inextricably linked to the assumption that philosophy is intuition-based. If you take away that assumption, the criticisms simply fall apart. Now, I think, you know, here's the kind of thing you could try. You could say, yeah, but look, don't you want philosophers to check whether they have biases? You know, what if it turns out that we're all biased because we are, you know, we have certain features and people with those features tend to make judgments of a certain kind. Isn't it nice to have a group of people who keeps us honest in that way? Right. So, you know, that would be one strategy to say, you know, what they're really doing is trying to discover maybe heuristics and biases in philosophy. And you know, put in that kind of terms, those terms, that sounds nice. Who wouldn't want to have some people checking on whether we're biased? But right. That just isn't a reasonable description of what anyone in that movement has even begun to do. Because I think there are ways, there are very interesting questions about the biases of philosophers. Like, what kind of gender bias? What's the source of gender biases? Are we biased in favor of certain kinds of subfield over other, certain types of writing rather than others? You know, those are all incredibly interesting things. But none of that gets close to the sort of work that they have been doing. What they thought they could do, and they still think they can do, is go into actual live philosophical debates, like the debate about the nature of knowledge, and make progress either critically or positively in that debate by checking on non-philosophers' so-called intuitions. Mm-hmm. That's just not going to get us anywhere, because those aren't the sorts of things that play a role dialectically in those debates. And of course, it's possible to think that in those debates, suppose you think philosophers have been biased in favor of contextualism. Mm-hmm. In epistemology. I mean, but that's not an argument that you can show or engage with by checking on undergraduates' responses to, you know, their intuitions about cases. The way we do that is we write philosophy papers saying, look, here is a bias in the literature. People have assumed such and such and such and such. I mean, there is a study of bias in philosophical texts, but that's just what we do when we do real philosophy. I mean, I'm just writing a book. Josh Dever and I have just finished a book on the sort of Perry-type cases. And yeah, we think there is a bias in that literature. We think it's biased in favor of the thought that indexicals play a specially important role in an explanation and rationalization of actions. And we think people haven't thought enough about that. But that's not something, but that bias isn't something you criticize by going around with questionnaires. It's something you question by doing real philosophy.
Well, okay, so let me just push this a little farther. I mean, not that I'm deeply in the experimental philosophy camp myself, but somebody might say, well, as you put it, you suggest you don't elaborate, but you suggest a sort of what you call a no theory theory of thought experiments, where they are, as you put it, devices to draw attention to philosophically interesting aspects of the world. And from that point of view, could X-Fi be contributing devices that draw attention to philosophically interesting aspects of the world?
No, I don't. Look, you could call X-Fi whatever you want, but yeah. I mean, you just make the label up to do something other than what they've been doing. But yeah. If it is the kind of thing that was started by Stitch and his pupils and that consists at its core of an exploration of non-philosophers' intuition, they're studied through questionnaires and other ways to check on immediate reactions to various kinds of cases, I can't prove that wouldn't be helpful. Seems completely hopeless to me as a way of engaging with. If you really start thinking seriously about cases, so take again the Perry case, I just don't see any addition to that literature coming from the sort of work that I just described. No. Yeah, again, these are empirical, but it's just I'm not very hopeful, let me put it like that. It doesn't look like the sort of thing that would bring that debate further along. Almost every possible position, every possible view you could have of what first-person belief or denunk belief is has been explored. What we need at this point is a unification of different theories, understanding of those phenomena in language, thought, action, perception. We need big theories that bring those things together. Those are incredibly complex issues, and they're the sorts of issues that you solve by doing good philosophy, of a just completely standard form. I mean, I don't have a procedure. I can't tell you how to do good philosophy. Okay? I mean, that's just very difficult, but it isn't something we need questionnaires for, as far as I can tell.
Okay. One of the suggestions, I mean, you consider the question of, how did this all begin? How did we all start using the intuition talk or developing thought experiments to elicit snap judgments or pre-theoretic, assumptions? And you mentioned Chomsky and his appeals to grammaticality judgments. And these, you might say, one might say, are really theoretically important, a methodology in which theoretically important judgments, are being elicited, all right, in order to, in his case, construct a grammar, a basic grammar. Maybe you could say a bit about how that may have influenced, how you think that may have influenced philosophers in their attempts to elicit judgments. And why perhaps that case really, really is different from the philosophical case?
Yeah, I just briefly about the bigger question that you started with. So how did this false self-conception come about? I think that is incredibly interesting, and I wish I was more of a historian of ideas and also had more patience to try to resolve that question. I simply just don't know. I consider a number of options at the sort of very briefly in the first part of the book, none of which strike me as particularly satisfactory. I think it's incredibly striking that prior to the 80s almost, you wouldn't find any leading philosophers who had this picture of philosophy. It wasn't part of, you know, Frege, Russell, Wittgenstein, Carnap, Quine, Davidson, even Rawls. You know, Rawls talks about intuitions, but he didn't think that was what drove philosophy more generally. I mean, more or less anyone that you pick as your favorite philosopher, it would be very hard pressed to find passages in which their methodological views were that philosophy at its foundation was driven by intuitions about thought experiments. So something happened, just what it is an interesting question. Jaakko Hintikka suggests in a paper that one thing that made a big difference was Chomsky. And maybe that's true. I find it a bit implausible that he had that much influence across philosophy, but it's an open question. Mm-hmm. And then to your more specific question, how should we think about what Chomsky is doing? I don't think it is very helpful to think of him as claiming that intuition in the sort of interesting philosophical sense is what you find at the as the basic evidence for a grammar or a syntax. First of all, this view wasn't worked out in any detail about what intuitions are in Chomsky, so it's very hard to tell. When you ask him about it, he disowned the term. He says, no, I didn't mean anything that has to do with anything interesting in the philosophical tradition. I mean, in a recent book on this, Peter Ludlow, a book that just came out this year, Ludlow describes the entire Chomskyan program without talking about intuitions at all. He just talks about competent speakers' judgments about grammaticality. And I guess that's my preferred way of thinking about it. Of course, then there's a story in Chomsky about the connection between those judgments and the language faculty. And you could spell that out in various ways. But no matter how you do that, there isn't a similar story to be told about what happens to our judgments about, say, Perry's case. Even if you could tell a story like that in the grammar case, it doesn't generalize in the required way to philosophy. But so I'm open to the thought that in other disciplines, maybe in mathematics, maybe in syntactic theory, people do something that's well described as relying on intuitions at a certain level. I mean, I'm a bit dubious, but that wasn't the topic of the book. So if it turns out that that's true about mathematics, say, or about syntax, all it shows, as far as I'm concerned, is that in that respect, those disciplines differ from philosophy.
Okay, so I think we have time for maybe one question, and I did want to raise the issue of conceptual analysis conceptual truth. So on your view, there isn't any real conceptual analysis going on. That's a very rough way to put it, but as a major methodological aspect of analytic philosophy, that's not what people are in the main doing. Since many people do see analytic philosophy as involved deeply in conceptual analysis, perhaps you can just discuss your view on that issue in particular.
Yeah, I think it's fairly easy to put. So just as I think many very, very good philosophers are mistaken when they describe their activity as being based on intuition, I think lots of very, very good philosophers mistakenly believe that what they engage in is something properly called conceptual analysis. And I mean, there are many levels to this criticism, but one is the more purely empirical approach that I was talking about earlier, and that mirrors the thing I was talking about with respect to intuitions. Roughly speaking, tell me what the characteristics are of something like conceptual analysis, and let's go and look at philosophical texts and see whether that's what's really going on. And the conclusion, here's my hypothesis, what you will find is that isn't what's going on. Whatever you think conceptual analysis is, you'll be surprised to see that that really isn't what goes on. People appeal to evidence of all kinds in all these important debates. There isn't an attempt to restrict oneself simply to judgments made relying on nothing but conceptual competence. You just don't find people doing that. That's an empirical claim. There's, of course, additional issues here that I don't go into fully in this book, and this is a way in which my book differs from Timothy Williamson. So Williamson's book is a full-out attack on the idea that there is such a thing as conceptual analysis. Williamson argues, and I think these arguments are incredibly strong, that just there is no such thing. And of course, if there's no such thing, then we don't do it. So you'd have to reply to those arguments. If you even thought that anyone did it, you'd have to respond to the Williamson-type arguments. But I only point this out in the book, and I don't think that I can, add anything really to what Williamson has to say. I mean, one thing I think is very helpful to think about here is that maybe the best work done on the notion of analyticity and conceptual truth and so on, mm-hmm. in contemporary philosophy is Paul Bogosian's. Paul Bogosian makes very modest claims. It's very interesting to look at the debate between him and Williamson, because Bogosian started out trying to show that there were certain kinds of judgments that you could make if you were a competent user of the word if, mm-hmm. That relied only on your conceptual competence. He then retreated after criticism from Williamson to and, that there were certain judgments. But so he's like trying, if he succeeds, he will have shown that and is a word such that when you're competent with it, there are certain judgments you're justified in based solely on your conceptual competence. But that's a very modest claim. I mean, and this is from the leading proponent of this idea. One little word, and. It's very hard to see how that expands throughout the rest of philosophy. And it's interesting to contrast Bogosian with the people who make sort of grandiose claims about conceptual analysis in philosophy. They never try to do the kind of detailed work that Bogosian is doing. So I think when you actually get down to doing the hard work of showing that conceptual analysis can be done, you'll feel very restricted and might be much less inclined to make these broad claims about its role in philosophy.
We are close to out of time. So I just wanted to ask you, you mentioned earlier you're working on another book, or you're completing another book, and maybe you could tell us what that is about.
It's the current title is Indexicality, Perspective, and the First Person, and it's about the role of first person thought and indexical thought in various areas of philosophy. So it spans many philosophical fields. We talk about the role of indexicality and first-person thought in action, in epistemology, perception, and in various other areas where it's often assumed that indexical thought can do distinctive and important explanatory work. And our general thesis is that indexicality plays much less of a role than is often assumed. It is a sort of anti-Perry Perry book, anti-Perry and anti-Lewis book. So you could also think of it as the myth of the first person. That's another way to think of this, that there isn't that kind of distinctive type of thought that plays an important explanatory role. But yeah, this is a very different project again.
So is there any contemplated follow-up to this particular book?
To the intuition book?
Yes.
So I've sort of finished that indexicality book, and what I'm very interested in now is there's one chapter in that book where I argue that the term intuition is defective, that it is a theoretically not just useless, but not just useless, but maybe even meaningless, because it is such a mess the way that term is used. I hedge that claim in the book because it should be part of a much larger theory of defective terms. And so I want to develop that theory much more about when theoretical terms are deficient, and maybe so deficient that they are completely meaningless. I think it's a very ubiquitous phenomenon in philosophy. Lots of terms are used in horrible ways, ways that are detrimental to inquiry. But it's not so the book, but I don't want that book to be just critical in that way. I also think it's a sort of a part of a more broad project about how philosophy of language can be critical and constructive at the same time. Because what I just described was a sort of philosophy of language move that criticized and evaluated a linguistic practice, didn't just describe it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm interested more generally in how philosophy of language can be evaluative of linguistic practices rather than just descriptive of them.
That sounds very interesting.
And it's connected to lots of work. For example, work done by Sally Haslinger on sort of terms like woman. And, so it has kind of wide-reaching implications. And I think the historical precedence is enormous. I mean, everything that started philosophy of language and maybe analytic philosophy as we know it in Frege and Russell and Carnap, part of its central motivation was the thought that certain parts of language were defective and that it had to be fixed. So we've sort of completely given up on that somehow. That has gone away, and all we're doing is descriptive semantics, but I think we should in some ways go back to their motivation, though in a very different way from how they were doing it.
That's it. I would think this problem is not just in philosophy. I think in science in particular, there's also a great deal of defective discourse, which has.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting to think about different kinds of defects and different diagnostics for defectiveness and so on, and mm-hmm. and that whole field hasn't really been worked out. So I'm kind of thinking of this as a very big project, as you say, for theoretical terms more generally.
Yeah, I look forward to reading what you have to say. But right now we are just out of time, so I just wanted to thank you very much for a very engaging conversation.
Okay, thanks very much for talking to me.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Herman Capellan, professor of philosophy at the R.K. Philosophical Research Center at the University of St. Andrews. I'm Carrie Figdor. This is New Books in Philosophy. I hope you've enjoyed the podcast, and thank you for listening.